Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 29th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our eighth study session on Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. We have two sessions left. One more next week. We will finish it up and be done moving forward. Folks have thoughts that they would like to share. Again, the folks who were excited about reading this book, who chose this book to read, what exactly did you expect? What did you think you were going to be reading when you chose this book, when you heard about it, and now that we, you know, are right on the doorstep to being done? What are your thoughts? What do you think of the recommendations that you heard, or, you know, folks advised you to read the book? What do you think of those recommendations now? Just very interesting that we have labored through it, got to the end. We are picking up this week on colonial war and mental disorders. I do think some of this is important. I think, in fact, you should recognize some of this to current times in terms of what we experience, observations that we have right now, in terms of how victims of white supremacy, black people in particular, how they suffer under this global system of terrorism. So I do think some of that would be interesting. Folks should keep in mind, keep some notes. He was a psychiatrist. Interesting observations to follow. Again, this is Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Colonial war and mental disorders. But the war goes on, and we will have to bind up for years to come the many, sometimes ineffable wounds that the colonialist onslaught has inflicted on our people. That imperialism which today is fighting against the true liberation of mankind leaves in its wake here and there tinctures of decay which we must search out and mercilessly expel from our land and our spirits. We shall deal here with the problem of mental disorders which arise from the war of national liberation which the Algerian people are carrying on. Perhaps these notes on psychiatry will be found ill-timed and singularly out of place in such a book, but we can do nothing about that. We cannot be held responsible that in this war psychiatric phenomena entailing disorders affecting behavior and thought have taken on importance where those who carry out the pacification are concerned, or that these same disorders are notable among the pacified population. The truth is that colonialism in its essence was already taking on the aspect of a fertile purveyor for psychiatric hospitals. We have, since 1954, in various scientific works, drawn the attention of both French and international psychiatrists to the difficulties that arise when seeking to cure a native properly. That is to say, when seeking to make him thoroughly a part of a social background of the colonial type. because it is a systematic negation of the other person and a furious determination to deny the other person all attributes of humanity, colonialism forces the people it dominates to ask themselves the question constantly, in reality, who am I? The defensive attitudes created by this violent bringing together of the colonized man and the colonial system form themselves into a structure which then reveals the colonized personality. This sensitivity is easily understood if we simply study and are alive to the number and depth of the injuries inflicted upon a native during a single day spent amidst the colonial regime. It must, in any case, be remembered that a colonized people is not only simply a dominated people. Under the German occupation, the French remained men. Under the French occupation, the Germans remained men. In Algeria, there is not simply the domination, but the decision to the letter not to occupy anything more than the sum total of the land. The Algerians, the veiled women, the palm trees, and the camels make up the landscape, the natural background to the human presence of the French. Hostile nature, obstinate and fundamentally rebellious, is in fact represented in the colonies by the bush, by mosquitoes, natives, and fever. And colonization is a success when all this indocile nature has finally been tamed. Railways across the bush, the draining of swamps, and a native population, which is non-existent politically and economically, are in fact one and the same thing. In the period of colonization, when it is not contested by armed resistance, when the sum total of harmful nervous stimuli overstepped a certain threshold, the defensive attitudes of the natives gives way, and then they find themselves crowding the mental hospitals. There is thus, during this calm period of successful colonization, a regular and important mental pathology which is the direct product of oppression. Today, the war of national liberation, which has been carried on by the Algerian people for the last 7 years, has become a favorable breeding ground for mental disorders, because so far as the Algerians are concerned, it is a total war. We shall mention here some Algerian cases which have been attended by us and who seem to us to be particularly eloquent. We need hardly say that we are not concerned with producing a scientific work. We avoid all arguments over semiology, nosology, or therapeutics. The few technical terms used serve merely as references. We must, however, insist on 2 points. Firstly, as a general rule, clinical psychiatry classifies the different disturbances shown by our patients under the heading reactionary psychosis. In doing this, prominence is given to the event which has given rise to the disorder. Although, in some cases, mention is made of the previous history of the case, the psychological, affective, and biological condition of the patient, and of the type of background from whence he comes. It seems to us that in the cases here chosen, the events giving rise to the disorder are chiefly the bloodthirsty and pitiless atmosphere, the generalization of inhuman practices, and the firm impression that people have of being caught up in a veritable apocalypse. Case number 2 of Series A is a typical reactionary psychosis, but case numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5 of Series B give evidence of a much more widely spread causality. Although we cannot really speak of one particular event giving rise to the disorders, these are reactionary psychosis. If we want to use a ready-made label, but here we must give particular priority to the war, a war which in whole and in part is a colonial war. After the two great world wars, there is no lack of publications on the mental pathology of soldiers taking part in action and civilians who are victims of evacuations and bombardments. The hitherto unemphasized characteristics of certain psychiatric descriptions here given confirm, if confirmation were necessary, that this colonial war is singular even in the pathology that it gives rise to. Another idea which is strongly held needs, in our opinion, to be re-examined. This is the notion of the relative harmlessness of these reactional disorders. It is true that others have described, but always as exceptional cases, certain secondary psychosis. That is to say, cases where the whole of the personality is disrupted definitively. It seems to us that here the rule is rather the frequent malignancy of these pathological processes. These are disorders which persist for months on end, making a mass attack against the ego, and practically always leaving as their sequel a weakness which is almost visible to the naked eye. According to all available evidence, the future of such patients is mortgaged. An example will best illustrate our point of view. In one of the African countries, which have been independent for several years, we had occasion to receive a visit from a patriot who had been in the resistance. This man, in his 30s, came to ask us for advice and help. For around a certain date each year, he suffered from prolonged insomnia, accompanied by anxiety and suicidal obsessions. The critical date was that when, on instructions from his organization, he had placed a bomb somewhere. 10 people had been killed as a result. This militant, who never for a single moment thought of repudiating his past action, realized very clearly the manner in which he himself had to pay the price of national independence. It is borderline cases such as his which raise the question of responsibility within the revolutionary framework. The observations noted here cover the period running from 1954 to 59. Certain patients were examined in Algeria, either in hospital centers or as private patients. The others were cared for by the health divisions of the Army of National Liberation. Series A. 5 cases are cited here. They are cases of Algerians or Europeans who had very clear symptoms of mental disorders of the reactionary type. Case number 1. Impotence in an Algerian following the rape of his wife. B. is a man 26 years old. He came to see us on the advice of the health service of the FLN for treatment of insomnia and persistent headaches. A former taxi driver, he had worked in the nationalist parties since he was 18. Since 1955, he had been a member of a branch of the FLN. He had several times used his taxi for the transport of political pamphlets and also political personnel. When the repression increased in ferocity, the FLN decided to bring the war into the urban centers. B thus came to have the task of driving commandos to the vicinity of attacking points, and quite often waited for them at those points to bring them back. One day, however, in the middle of the European part of the town, after fairly considerable fighting, a very large number of arrests forced him to abandon his taxi, and the commando unit broke up and scattered. B, who managed to escape through the enemy lines, took refuge at a friend's house. Some days later, without having been able to get back to his home, on the orders of his superiors, he joined the nearest band of the Maquis. For several months, he was without news of his wife and his little girl of 1 year and 8 months. On the other hand, he learned that the police spent several weeks on end searching the town. After 2 years spent in the Maquis, he received a message from his wife in which she asked him to forget about her, for she had been dishonored, and he ought not to think of taking up their life together again. He was extremely anxious, and asked his commander's leave to go home secretly. This was refused him, but on the other hand measures were taken for a member of the FLN to make contact with B's wife and parents. 2 weeks later, a detailed report reached the commander of B's unit. His abandoned taxi had been discovered with two machine gun magazines in it. Immediately afterward, French soldiers accompanied by policemen went to his house. Finding he was absent, they took his wife away and kept her for over a week. She was questioned about the company her husband kept and beaten fairly brutally for 2 days. But the third day, a French soldier, she was not able to say whether he was an officer, made the others leave the room and then raped her. Some time later, a second soldier, this time with others present, raped her, saying to her, "If ever you see your filthy husband again, don't forget to tell him what we did to you." She remained another week without undergoing any fresh questioning. After this, she was escorted back to her dwelling. When she told her story to her mother, the latter persuaded her to tell B everything. Thus, as soon as contact was re-established with her husband, she confessed her dishonor to him. Once the first shock had passed, and since, moreover, every minute of his time was filled by activity, B was able to overcome his feelings. For several months, he had heard many stories of Algerian women who had been raped or tortured, and he had occasion to see the husbands of these violated women. Thus, his personal misfortunes and his dignity as an injured husband remained in the background. In 1958, he was entrusted with a mission abroad. When it was time to rejoin his unit, certain fits of absence of mind and sleeplessness made his comrades and superiors anxious about him. His departure was postponed, and it was decided he should have a medical examination. This was when we saw him. He seemed at once easy to get to know, a mobile face, perhaps a bit too mobile. Smiles slightly exaggerated, surface, well-being. "I'm really very well indeed. I'm feeling better now. Give me a tonic or two, a few vitamins, and I'll build myself up a bit." A basic anxiety came up to break the surface. He was at once sent to the hospital. From the second day on, the screen of optimism melted away, and what we saw in front of us was a thoughtful, depressed man, suffering from loss of appetite, who kept to his bed. He avoided political discussion and showed a marked lack of interest in everything to do with the national struggle. He avoided listening to any news which had a bearing on the War of Liberation. Any approach to his difficulties was extremely long. But at the end of several days, we were able to reconstruct his story. During his stay abroad, he tried to carry through a sexual affair which was unsuccessful. Thinking that this was due to fatigue, a normal result of forced marches and periods of undernourishment, he again tried 2 weeks later. Fresh failure. Talked about it to a friend who advised him to try vitamin B12. Took this in the form of pills. Another attempt, another failure. Moreover, a few seconds before the act, he had an irresistible impulse to tear up a photo of his little girl. Such a symbolic liaison might have caused us to think that unconscious impulsions of an incestuous nature were present. However, several interviews and a dream in which the patient saw the rapid rotting away of a little cat, accompanied by unbearably evil smells, led us to take quite another course. "That girl," he said to us one day, speaking of his little daughter, "has something rotten about her." From this period on, his insomnia became extremely marked, and in spite of fairly large doses of neuroleptics, a state of anxiety, excitation was remarked, which the service found rather worrying. Then he spoke to us for the first time about his wife, laughing and saying to us, "She's tasted the French." It was at that moment that we reconstructed the whole story. The weaving of events to form a pattern was made explicit. He told us that before every sexual attempt, he thought of his wife. All his confidences appeared to us to be of fundamental interest. "I married this girl, although I loved my cousin. But my cousin's parents had arranged a match for their daughter with somebody else. So I accepted the first wife my parents found for me. She was nice, but I didn't love her. I used always to say to myself, 'You're young yet, wait a bit, and when you found the right girl, you'll get a divorce and you'll make a happy marriage.' So you see, I wasn't very attached to my wife, and with the troubles, I got further apart than ever. In the end, I used to come and eat my meals and sleep almost without speaking to her. In the Marquise, when I heard that she'd been raped by the French, I first of all felt angry with the swine. Then I said, 'Oh, well, there's not much harm done. She wasn't killed. She can start her life over again.' And then a few weeks later, I came to realize that they'd raped her because they were looking for me. In fact, it was to punish her for keeping silence that she'd been violated. She could have very well told them at least the name of one of the chaps in the movement, and from that, they could have searched out the whole network, destroyed it, and maybe even arrested me. That wasn't a simple rape, for one of something better to do, or for sadistic reasons like those I've had occasion to see in the villages. It was the rape of an obstinate woman who was ready to put up with everything rather than sell her husband. And the husband in question, it was me. This woman had saved my life and had protected the organization. It was because of me that she had been dishonored. And yet she didn't say to me, 'Look at all I've had to bear for you.' On the contrary, she said, 'Forget about me. Begin your life over again, for I have been dishonored.' It was from that very moment on that I made my own decision to take back my wife after the war. For it must be said that I've seen peasants drying the tears of their wives after having seen them raped under their very eyes. This left me very much shaken. I must admit, moreover, that at the beginning I couldn't understand their attitude, but we increasingly came to intervene in such circumstances in order to explain matters to the civilians. I've seen civilians willingly proposing marriage to a girl who was violated by the French soldiers, and who was with child by them. All this led me to reconsider the problem of my wife. So I decided to take her back, but I didn't know at all how I'd behave when I saw her, and often while I was looking at the photo of my daughter, I used to think that she too was dishonored. Like as if everything that had to do with my wife was rotten. They tortured her or knocked out all her teeth or broken an arm, I wouldn't have minded. But that thing, how can you forget a thing like that? And why did she have to tell me about it at all?" He then asked me if his sexual failing was, in my opinion, caused by his worries. I replied, "It is not impossible." Then he sat up in bed. "What would you do if all this happened to you?" "I don't know." "Would you take back your wife?" "I think I would." "Ah, there you are, you see. You're not quite sure." He held his head in his hands and after a few seconds left the room. From that day on, he was progressively more willing to listen to political discussions, and at the same time, the headaches and lack of appetite lessened considerably. After 2 weeks, he went back to his unit, Before he left, he told me, "When independence comes, I'll take my wife back. If it doesn't work out between us, I'll come and see you in Algiers." Case number 2. Undifferentiated homicidal impulsions found in a survivor of a mass murder. S, 37 years old, a fella, comes from a village in the country around Constantine. Never took any part in politics from the outset of the war. His district was the scene of fierce battles between the Algerian forces and the French army. S thus had occasion to see dead and wounded, but he continued to keep out of things. From time to time, however, in common with the people as a whole, the peasantry of his village used to come to the aid of Algerian fighting men who were passing through. But one day, early in 1958, a deadly ambush was laid not far from the village. After this, the enemy forces went into operation and besieged the village, which in fact had no soldiers in it. All the inhabitants were summoned and questioned. Nobody replied. A few hours after, a French officer arrived by helicopter and said, "There's been too much talk about this village. Destroy it." The soldiers began to set fire to the houses, while the women, who were trying to get a few clothes together or save some provisions, were driven away by blows with rifle butts. Some peasants took advantage of the general confusion to run away. The officer gave the order to bring together the men who remained and had them brought out to a near watercourse where the killing began. 29 men were shot at point-blank range. S was wounded by 2 bullets, which went through his right thigh and his left arm, respectively. The arm injury gave rise to a fracture of the humerus. S fainted and came to find himself in the midst of a group of ALN. He was treated by the health service and evacuated as soon as it was possible to move him. While on the way, his behavior became more and more abnormal and worried his escort continuously. He demanded a gun, although he was helpless and a civilian, and refused to walk in front of anybody, no matter who they were. He refused to have anyone behind him. One night, he got hold of a soldier's gun and awkwardly tried to fire on the sleeping soldiers. He was disarmed rather roughly. From then on, they tied his hands together, and it was thus that he arrived at the center. He began by telling us that he wasn't dead yet and that he had played a good trick on the others. Bit by bit, we managed to reconstruct his story of the assassination he had attempted. S was not anxious. He was, in fact, rather overexcited, with violent phases of agitation accompanied by screaming. He did not break anything much, but tired everybody out by his incessant chatter. The whole service was permanently on the alert on account of his declared intention of killing everybody. During his stay in the hospital, he attacked about 8 patients with makeshift weapons. Nurses and doctors were not spared either. We almost wondered whether we were not witnessing one of those masked forms of epilepsy, which is characterized by a wholesale aggressivity which is nearly always present. Deep sleep treatment was then tried. From the third day on, a daily interview made it possible for us to better understand the moving force of the pathological process. The patient's intellectual confusion progressively toned down. Here are some extracts from his statements. "God is with me, but he certainly isn't with those who are dead. I have hellish good luck. In life, you've got to kill so as not to be killed. When I think that I knew nothing at all about all that business. There are Frenchmen in our midst. They disguise themselves as Arabs. They've all got to be killed. Give me a machine gun. All these so-called Algerians are really Frenchmen, and they won't leave me alone. As soon as I want to go to sleep, they come into my room. But now I know all about them. Everyone wants to kill me, but I'll defend myself. I'll kill them all, every single one of them. I'll cut their throats one after the other, and yours with them. You all want to kill me, but you should set about it differently. I'd kill you all as soon as look at you. Big ones and little ones. Women, children, dogs, birds, donkeys. Everyone will be dead. And afterwards, I'll be able to sleep in peace. All this was said in jerks. The patient's attitude remained hostile, suspicious, and aloof. After 3 weeks, his state of excitement had disappeared, but a certain reticence and a tendency to seek solitude gave us grounds for fearing a more serious evolution of his disorder. However, after a month, he asked to be let out in order to learn a trade that would be compatible with his disability. He was then entrusted to the care of the social service of the FLN. We saw him 6 months after, and he was going on well. Case number 3. Marked anxiety psychosis of the depersonalization type after the murder of a woman while temporarily insane. DJ, a former student, a soldier in the ALN, 19 years old. His illness already dated from some months back by the time he came to the center. His appearance was characteristic. He seemed very depressed, his hands were constantly moist, and his lips were dry. His chest was lifted by continual sighs. Pernicious insomnia, 2 attempts at suicide since the trouble started. During the conversation, he struck hallucinatory attitudes while listening. Sometimes his glance fixed itself for a few seconds on a point in space, while his face lit up, giving the impression to observers that the patient was witnessing a play. Thoughts woolly. Certain phenomena known in psychiatry by the name of blocking, a gesture or phrase is begun and then suddenly interrupted without apparent reason. But in particular, one element aroused our particular attention. The patient talked of his blood being spilt, of his arteries which were being empty, and of his heart which kept missing a beat. He implored us to stop the hemorrhage and not to let him be, quote, sucked by a vampire, within the very precincts of the hospital. Sometimes he could not speak any more and asked us for a pencil. Wrote, I have lost my voice. My whole life is ebbing away. This living depersonalization gave us reason to believe that the illness had reached a serious stage of development. Several times during the course of our conversations, the patient spoke to us of a woman who, when night fell, came to persecute him. Having learnt beforehand that his mother, whom he had been very fond of, was dead, and that nothing had been able to console him for her loss, his voice had considerably sunk as he spoke of her, and he shed some tears. I directed the investigation toward the maternal image. When I asked him to describe the woman who obsessed him, I might even say persecuted him, he declared that she was not an unknown person, that he knew her very well, and that it was he who had killed her. It was thus a matter of finding out whether he had to deal with an unconscious guilt complex following on the death of the mother. As Freud has described in Mourning and Melancholia. We asked the patient to talk to us about this woman in greater detail, since he had known her so well, and since also it was he who had killed her. Thus, we were able to reconstruct the following story. I left the town where I had been a student to join the Maquis. After some months, I had news of my people. I learnt that my mother had been killed point blank by a French soldier, and two of my sisters had been taken to the soldiers' quarters. Up to now, I have had no news of what happened to them. I was terribly shaken by the death of my mother. Since my father had died some years before, I was the only man in the family, and my sole ambition had always been to manage to do something to make life easier for my mother and my sisters. One day we went to an estate belonging to settlers, where the agent, who was an active colonialist, had already killed two Algerian civilians. We came to his house at night, but he wasn't there. Only his wife was at home. When she saw us, she started to cry and implored us not to kill her. "I know you've come for my husband," she said, "but he isn't here. I've told him again and again not to have anything to do with politics." We decided to wait for her husband, but as far as I was concerned, when I looked at that woman, I thought of my mother. She was sitting in an armchair, and her thoughts seemed to be elsewhere. I wondered why we didn't kill her. Then all of a sudden she noticed I was looking at her. She flung herself upon me screaming, "Please, please don't kill me. I have children." A moment after she was dead, I killed her with my knife. My commander disarmed me and ordered me to leave. I was questioned by the platoon commander a few days later. I thought I was going to be shot, but I didn't give a damn. And then I started vomiting after every meal, and I slept badly. After that, this woman started coming every night and asking for my blood. But my mother's blood, where is that? At nightfall that evening, as soon as the patient went to bed, the room was, quote, invaded by women, in spite of everything. It was a manifold repetition of the same woman. Every one of them had an open wound in their stomach. They were bloodless, pale, and terribly thin. They tormented the young patient and insisted that he should give them back their spilt blood. At this moment, the sound of running water filled the room and grew so loud that it seemed like a thundering waterfall, and the young patient saw the parquet of his room drenched with blood, his blood, while the women slowly got their color back, and their wounds began to close up. The patient awoke, bathed with sweat and in deep distress, and remained in a state of nervous excitement until dawn. The young patient was treated for several weeks, after which time the ornithroid symptoms, nightmares, had practically disappeared. However, a serious deficiency remained in his personality. When he started thinking of his mother, the disemboweled woman rose up before him in redoubled horror. Though it may appear unscientific, in our opinion, time alone can bring some improvement to the disrupted personality of this young man. Case number 4. A European policeman in a depressed state meets, while under hospital treatment, one of his victims, an Algerian patriot who is suffering from stupor. A, 28 years old, no children. We learnt that for several years both he and his wife underwent treatment, unfortunately with no success, in order to have children. He was sent to us by his superiors because he had behavior disturbances. Immediate contact seemed fairly good. The patient spoke to us spontaneously about his difficulties, satisfactory relations with his wife and parents-in-law. His trouble was that at night he heard screams which prevented him from sleeping. In fact, he told us that for the last few weeks before going to bed, he shut the shutters and stopped up all the windows. It was summer. To the complete despair of his wife, who was stifled by the heat. Moreover, he stuffed his ears with cotton wool in order to make the screams seem less piercing. He sometimes, even in the middle of the night, turned on the wireless, or put on some music in order not to hear this nocturnal uproar. He consequently explained to us at full length the whole story that was troubling him. A few nights before, he had been transferred to an anti-FLN brigade. At the beginning, he was entrusted with surveying certain shops or cafes, but after some weeks, he used to work almost exclusively at the police headquarters. Here he came to deal with interrogations, and these never occurred without some, quote, knocking about. The thing was that they never would own up to anything. He explained, "Sometimes we almost wanted to tell them that if they had a bit of consideration for us, they'd speak out, without forcing us to spend hours tearing information word by word out of them. But you might as well talk to the wall. To all the questions we ask, they only say, 'I don't know.' Even when we ask them what their name was, if we ask them where they live, they say, 'I don't know.' So, of course, we have to go through with it. But they scream too much. At the beginning, that made me laugh, but afterward I was a bit shaken. Nowadays, as soon as I hear someone shouting, I can tell you exactly at what stage of questioning we've got to. The chap who's had two blows of the fist and a belt of the baton behind his ear has a certain way of speaking, of shouting, and of saying he's innocent. After he's been left 2 hours strung up by his wrist, he has another kind of voice. After the bath, still another, and so on. But above all, it's after the electricity that it becomes really too much. You say that the chap was going to die any minute. Of course, there are some that don't scream. Those are the tough ones. But they think they're going to be killed right away. But we're not interested in killing them. What we want is information. When we're dealing with those tough ones, the first thing we do is make them squeal, and sooner or later we manage it. That's already a victory. Afterward, we go on. Mind you, we like to avoid that. But they don't make things easy for us. Now I've come so as I hear their screams, even when I'm at home. Especially the screams of the ones who died at the police headquarters. Doctor, I'm fed up with this job, and if you manage to cure me, I'll ask to be transferred to France. If they refuse, I'll resign." Faced with such a picture, I prescribed sick leave. As the patient in question refused to go to the hospital, I treated him privately. One day, shortly before the therapeutic treatment was due to begin, I had an urgent call from my department. When A reached my house, my wife asked him to wait for me, but he preferred to go for a walk in the hospital grounds and then come back to meet me. A few minutes later, as I was going home, I passed him on the way. He was leaning against a tree, looking overcome, trembling, and drenched with sweat. In fact, having an anxiety crisis. I took him into my car and drove him to my house. Once he was lying on the sofa, he told me he had met one of my patients in the hospital who had been questioned in the police barracks. He was an Algerian patriot and who was under treatment for disorders of a stuporous nature following on shock. I then learned that the policeman had taken an active part in inflicting torture on my patient. I administered some sedatives which calmed A's anxiety. After he had gone, I went to the house in the hospital where the patriot was being cared for. The personnel had noticed nothing, but the patient could not be found. Finally, we managed to discover him in a toilet where he was trying to commit suicide. He, on his side, had recognized the policeman and thought that he had come to look for him and take him back again to the barracks. Afterward, A came back to see me several times, and after a very definite improvement in his condition, managed to get back to France on account of his health. As for the Algerian patriot, the personnel spent a long time convincing him that the whole thing was an illusion. that policemen were not allowed inside the hospital, that he was very tired, that he was there to be looked after, etc. Case number 5, a European police inspector who tortured his wife and children. R, 30 years old, came of his own accord to consult us. He was a police inspector and stated that for several weeks, quote, things weren't working out. Married, had 3 children. He smoked a lot, 5 packs of cigarettes a day. He had lost his appetite, and his sleep was frequently disturbed by nightmares. These nightmares had no special distinguishing features. What bothered him most were what he called, quote, fits of madness. In the first place, he disliked being contradicted. Can you give me an explanation for this, doctor? As soon as someone goes against me, I want to hit him. Even outside my job, I feel I want to settle the fellows who get in my way, even for nothing at all. Look here, for example, suppose I go to the kiosk to buy some papers. There's a lot of people. Of course you have to wait. I hold out my hand. The chap who keeps the kiosk is a pal of mine to take my papers. Someone in the line gives me a challenging look and says, "Wait your turn." Well, I feel I want to beat him up, and I say to myself, quote, if I had you for a few hours, my fine fellow, you wouldn't look so clever afterwards. The patient dislikes noise. At home, he wants to hit everybody all the time. In fact, he does hit his children, even the baby of 20 months, with unaccustomed savagery. But what really frightened him was one evening when his wife had criticized him particularly for hitting his children too much. She had even said to him, "My word, anyone think you were going mad?" He threw himself upon her, beat her, and tied her to a chair, saying to himself, quote, "I'll teach her once and for all that I'm master in this house." Fortunately, his children began roaring and crying. He then realized the full gravity of his behavior, untied his wife, and the next day decided to consult a doctor, a nerve specialist. He stated that before he wasn't like that. He said that he very rarely punished his children and, at all events, never fought with his wife. The present phenomena had appeared, quote, since the troubles. The fact is, he said, nowadays we have to work like troopers. Last week, for example, we operated like as if we belonged to the army. Those gentlemen in the government say there's no war in Algeria, and that the arm of the law, that's to say the police, ought to restore order. But there is a war going on in Algeria, and when they wake up to it, it'll be too late. The thing that kills me most is the torture. You don't know what that is, do you? Sometimes I torture people for 10 hours at a stretch. What happens to you when you are torturing? You may not realize, but it's very tiring. It's true, we take it in turns, but the question is to know when to let the next chap have a go. Each one thinks he's going to get the information at any minute and takes good care not to let the bird go to the next chap after he's softened him up nicely. When, of course, the other chap would get the honor and glory of it. So sometimes we let them go, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we even offer the chap money out of our own pockets to try to get him to talk. Our problem is as follows. Are you able to make this fellow talk? It's a question of personal success. You see, you're competing with the others. In the end, your fists are ruined, so you call in the Senegalese. But either they hit too hard and destroy the creature, or else they don't hit hard enough and it's no good. In fact, you have to be intelligent to make a success of that sort of work. You have to know when to lay it on and when to lay it off. You have to have a flair for it. When the chap is softened up, it's not worth your while going on and hitting him. That's why you have to do the work yourself. You can judge better how you're getting on. I'm against the ones that have the chap dealt with by others and simply come to see every hour or so what state he's in. Above all, what you mustn't do is to give the chap the impression that he won't get away alive from you, because then he wonders what's the use of talking if that won't save his life. In that case, you'll have no chance at all of getting anything out of him. He must go on hoping. Hope, the thing that'll make him talk. But the thing that worries me most is this affair with my wife. It's certain that there's something wrong with me. You've got to cure me, doctor. His superiors refused to give him sick leave, and since, moreover, the patient did not wish to have a psychiatrist's certificate, we tried to give him treatment, quote, while working full-time. The weakness of such a procedure may easily be imagined. This man knew perfectly well that his disorders were directly caused by the kind of activity that went on inside the rooms where interrogations were carried out, even though he tried to throw the responsibility totally upon present troubles, as he could not see his way to stopping torturing people. That made nonsense to him, for in that case he would have to resign. He asked me, without beating around the bush, to help him to go on torturing Algerian patients without any pricklings of conscience, without any behavior problems, and with complete equanimity.
Context of white supremacy. Our first audio segment, Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth. We will pick up for the second audio segment. Will be on Series B. Series B, I think for me, that's on page 270. I guess it might, you know, depend on which version of the text you have. Anywho, as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, we have one session left. Obviously, we have the second audio segment today, but next week, we are all done. Thank goodness. Woo! Stuck it out for those listening to the archives and or folks who dial in. Thanks for sticking it out. I have been very vocal about my displeasure for this book even before we started it, and other people as well, and saying that they were a bit bummed that it wasn't more entertaining, or I shouldn't even say entertaining, that it was not of a greater constructive value. I think people have kind of said in unison that they've had a difficult time applying what they've learned, even coherently understanding what they've heard and or read, much less applying what's being presented in The Wretched of the Earth. But we are almost done. And as I said, this book is referenced so much, I'm sure when we have future guests on the program, if this text is mentioned, we should have some very interesting questions. That said, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the conversation, but you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line to call in. The address for the VOPE line, it's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need that address, it is tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. That address again for the free VOPE line, tiny.ty.cc/oneRace. When you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You will see a link for the free VOPE line. Click it. When you do so, it'll open a small window on your screen on the first line. Drop-down menu, select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943. Excuse me, the code that's on the second line, again, 564-943.
1-800-273-9943. Put that on the second line. And then the final line, you can, it will ask for a name. You can enter a real name, a nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It's the same procedure. If you wish to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61 and we will see your hand on the line and get you on the broadcast. You can share your views. That way, that said, let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you all have commentary you would like to share, feel free. We have Mr. Demery Four. Line should be open. Other folks, if you have commentary, I'll look out and get your hands as well.
Greetings. May I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Four.
All right. Greetings, Gus. I want to start out at the beginning. The first sentence of this reading, you know, where he uses the word unethical, and in my book, the word is indelible. When he's talking about the wounds inflicted on our people by the colonist onslaught. And I thought that was odd because he used unethical instead of unethical. And if you look a word up, I guess they're interchangeable, but they have totally different meanings. And I don't know, I guess it may have been in the translation, but indelible is used to describe the wounds inflicted on our people by the colonials, meaning it cannot be eradicated, ineractable, permanent, ingrained in your mind. It's a permanent wound that I think later on he described the things as the wounds as being benign or malignant. And if one is permanent, then it's not changing. It's going to be around, and it'll probably get worse. Then later on, he goes on to describe when he was talking about, when he gives the reason for adding notes on psychiatry in the book, he gives the explanation that he had no control over the fact that there were psychiatric phenomena and the mental and behavior disorders emerging from the war. But then he used the word that these disorders loomed large among the perpetrators of pacification as well as the pacified population. So we go on to think that, well, okay, we got war going on. You're going to have casualties on both sides, you know, but I think he shows clearly later on that those that are on the other side that are not the colonizer, the colonized subject, are the ones that suffer the most. And he talked about since 1954 that attention has been given to international psychiatrists, French and international psychiatrists on scientific work on the difficulty of curing the colonized subject correctly. But I think that, in my opinion, that this scientific work that they're doing to control non-white, especially black people, goes further back than 1954, brings to mind of the renowned racist Dr. Samuel A. Cartwright, who, through his pseudo-scientific jargon, came up with drapomania, which is supposed to have been some type of disease that the slaves had that would explain them running away. psychotic reactions. You know, I just get right to when he started talking about these cases, I thought it was really strange, or it's quite odd that he wouldn't even, it didn't even get to the cases yet, but he gave a certain individual that came from an African country, and this man was in his 30s, and he was afflicted. He couldn't sleep. He had anxiety attacks and had obsessions with suicide around a certain time of the year. So come to find out, he had been ordered to set a bomb off in a cafe. And then if you read the footnotes underneath there, you'll see that this restaurant was frequented by known racists. So the element of black and white is in there because the colonists that he's working against would be the French, right? So he blows up this cafe, and then now it said that every time certain date of the year, a critical date that corresponds with the time the bomb went off, he comes down with all these symptoms. And, you know, what I found interesting is at the end of these cases, he always gives like a diagnosis or a synopsis. And it said that the militant who never for a moment had thought of recanting fully realized the price he had to pay in his person for national independence. Such borderline cases pose the question of responsibility in the context of revolution. I think he gave this case because this was going to be an exceptional case. He said that there were different types of psychotic reactions, but the anniversary type reaction was different and exceptional. And then he went on with these other cases involving different types of causes. But what we can see is that each one of these cases, it looks like that they suffer from post-traumatic stress. And what's especially interesting is the one when the Algerian patriot saw the police officer, how he reacted to the police officer, and then how the police officer reacted. And then I guess it was Frantz Fanon himself took the white guy, put him in his car, took him home, and comforted him on his own couch and everything. But the Algerian patriot was still under the influence that the police was coming after him, and he was in a state of hysteria. And all they were giving him was drugs. So in the end, his prognosis wasn't good, but the police officer ended up making out, I guess, with a retirement, and looks as though he was doing a lot better in the end. But that the part about the impotency, you know, that was, a lot of these cases are complex, it seems, but with the backdrop of a war, you know that it's exaggerated. The one guy was selfish and not wanting his wife after she had endured the rape scene, but then at the same time realized that the rape scene had been caused by his activities in freedom fight. So it seems to be interesting in this part of the reading because he's getting into areas that we know that he had expertise in, and then he's letting us into the insight of what could be going on in some of these people's minds, both the patriots and the police officers that were exacting torture upon the rebels. So I have more, but I'll mute my line in case someone else is out there that wants to say something, but I can come back again later. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For really quick, was it your impression when he's given these cases, anecdotal cases, and he's talking about officers and the folks who, you know, did these torturings and beatings, was it your impression that some of these folks were non-white people who were doing this in order to support the French regime, or were these white people that were carrying out these beatings?
Yes. Well, I think most of them were white people, and I see a part in here where the guy said they were torturing them so bad that they would beat up their fists. They couldn't go anymore on beating them, so they would bring in the Senegalese, which were probably other Africans, to continue the beatings on these non-white people. And you can see the anti-blackness involved in that, because it said that the Senegalese would hit especially hard and be especially brutal on them, you know, for whatever that comes to, because how can you believe him? He's a torturer himself. So I think that most of them were white doing that, because they even brought up the part about when the Germans occupied the French, they remained human. And then when the French occupied the Germans, they remained human. But then under this circumstance, there's insanity everywhere, and the insane asylums are loading up.
Appreciate that. If other folks, if you listened, your commentary is only valuable if you actually listened to the sections where, or read the sections where the folks that are doing the torturings and beatings in Algeria, if you think these are white people, or if they're specific terms that you feel like, oh yeah, that's, see, right there, these are people that'd be classified as white, or are these people that are classified as non-white, some of both. If you have thoughts on that, that would be appreciated. I ask because, and expect, well, really any time, but in particular in this time period, 1960s, in many instances, racists would employ black people to do this. And this continued all the way up, like, I mean, really 2017. But I was thinking specifically with South Africa and Madiba, that a lot of times you would have black people, other black people, that would be their job. You're going to be the one that's going to do forced rapings of freedom fighters and folks in the ANC, or you're going to be the ones, black people, you're going to be the ones that go out and do beatings of other black people that are members of the Mkontwe Sizwe, that has been long running part of racist strategy. So I was thinking, wow. And it struck me as kind of unusual, I guess I would say, if in the 1960s, if you had white people going and talking about their anxieties and impotency with a Negro, even a psychiatrist Negro, that at least would strike me as, you know, something that might even warrant an extra comment or three from Fanon in the book. But if folks have, you know, additional comments around that, who the racial classification of the folks that are being presented here, chime in. Let me make sure I was going to share my thoughts and make sure we didn't, I'm not skipping over folks who have commentary. If you do have a thought, folks that are listening in, feel free. Some of the things that I noted from this section. Before I even get to my notes, when Mr. Derman Ford was talking about the change in wording, where it was indelible, I think you said in the audio that we heard, he used the term unethical. And then in your book, it was indelible, I believe, if my memory is correct. Just that sort, those sorts of changes. I do not read French. If I did, and if I liked this book more, it would be very interesting to sit down with this book, listen to the English, and or just have the English and the French copy side by side, and maybe even get a few different versions of the translation and sit them down together and just look at, you know, how was this translated, and
are you going to be reading a totally different book depending on, do you read it in French? Which translation do you read? Which words do they pick? It's huge for a book that I would submit is already very challenging to read, and a book that many people have said you're not going to understand it even after reading six times. You're not going to understand all parts of it. That just makes it even more confounding. If it's almost like you got three or four different versions of the same book, depending on which translation you got. Now, to the notes that I took for this week. Let's see, the first one where he says, the anxiety that was presented. Mr. Deming talked about this case where the enforcement official participated in this bombing. This was one of the natives. Excuse me, this was not an enforcement official. This is one of the natives who was fighting back and who placed a bomb in the cafe where the racists were. I read the footnote that Mr. Deming Ford was talking about where they said, a lot of racists hung out at this cafe. And then the next sentence it added, but there was nothing to prevent a quite ordinary passerby from going in and having a drink. That immediately reminded me of Mr. Fuller's commentary on counterviolence and why he emphasizes that if you are going to engage in counterviolence, it's supposed to be planned out so that there are no whoopses. It's no collateral damage. It's no chance that in your effort to go out and neutralize a racist, it's no possible way that an accidental non-white person or eight will also be harmed, killed in the process. That is not supposed to ever happen. That if you are going to use counterviolence, it still should be about ending racism and violence happening to non-white people. If your counterviolent action is just going to have more non-white people being harmed, then how is that making anything any better? That's just more what we already got. Very important. I think a lot of times that gets minimized, ignored when people read and or talk about Mr. Fuller's work. And just period, when people talk about counterviolence, I think I referenced that with the Michael Johnson situation in 2016, because I think some non-white people were harmed in that situation. Pretty much any time that there's some sort of counterviolence that people get excited about, that's one of the first things that I go to, like, wait a minute, were there any black people harmed? If any black people were harmed, this is not counterviolence. This is not something that we should celebrate. All of our acts to end racism should be about making sure that non-white people are no longer being injured. Very important point that came to mind as we read. The next portion or next note that I got, this is from the first case that he presents, Series A, case number one, impotence in Algeria following the rape of, or impotence in an Algerian following the rape of his wife. Sexual intercourse featured pretty prominently in many of these segments, also in Black Skin, White Mask, of course. Just for me, just emphasizing that sexual exploitation, sexual violence, really, is a primary tactic of the system of white supremacy. All of this reminded me, I think we talked about this, whether you want to put it in context of Daniel Holtzclaw, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, Mary Kay Letourneau, educator out here in Seattle, Washington, who was having sexual intercourse with her non-white student, ended up marrying him after she was jailed twice for this child rape, serial child rapist, doing it repeatedly. That is just an integral part of racism, white supremacy. And if it's, oh, well, you know, we're trying to get this information and you don't want to tell us, well, then we'll rape you and laugh about it. You know, our goal is not to kill you. And just in my view, you see that consistently. That was a huge aspect of what came up in South Africa, particularly in the Truth and Reconciliation trials, rape being used in the same manner. And specifically there, that was why I asked the question. In South Africa, again, racists, sometimes they would get other black people to do this. They wouldn't be the one to go in and commit these acts of sexual terrorism. They would just go get another black person and do the exact same thing. Oh, you don't want to give up your husband and what he's doing in the movement. Okay, well, we'll just rape you and whatever else we want to do. And, you know, maybe you'll think about, you know, snitching him out. Maybe you won't. If you don't, Well, then you can just think about that for, you know, the rest of your life. And maybe we'll kill you on top of it if you don't want to give up the goods, the information. Standard operating procedure. It seems to be a standard operating procedure worldwide for racists. Let's see. The portion for me, this is on 258. Let's see. When the Algerian male, when he, I guess, begins to understand, like, oh, okay, this happened as a result of me. I think that happens in the system of white supremacy a lot as well, where non-white people, where we see, like, oh, man, the other non-white people that we care about, other black people that we care about, they are being harmed. They are being impacted by our choices, particularly if we choose to fight against racism, white supremacy. I certainly recall we read Long Walk to Freedom on the book club. That's one I can reference for some of the reference points I've been talking about. But I also recall the legend James Meredith, someone I have just extraordinary admiration for. He was one of the first, I believe he was the first black student to enter the University of Mississippi, to enroll at the University of Mississippi in 1962. He said that, hey, I didn't care. If they were going to kill me on my efforts to end white supremacy, that was what was going to happen. I had a mission, that this is what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to solve this problem. That was the way he talked. The only time that I heard him give any hesitation was he said, you know, James Meredith was a veteran as well. He said that they were attacking his family, that he, you know, knew what he signed up for. That he wasn't scared. He didn't ask for any protection. He was going about his business, but his family back home, mother, father, other people that he cared about, when they started being threatened, maybe we can't get you, but we'll kill your family. That sort of thing I've seen consistently where that bothers a lot of black people. And again, just let you know is the absolute lack of conscience that race soldiers have, where you are not necessarily doing anything incorrect, just trying to work towards justice. And it's, well, if we can't get you, or even if we can get you, you might have upset us so much that we'll go and get your children too. We'll go and get your wife too. We'll go and get your grandparents too. Anybody else that's connected to you, we'll go and harass and maybe even kill them too, to set an example to the rest of the niggers of what could happen to you all, or Kafirs, wherever you happen to be in the world. That lets you the pathology that we're dealing with talking about white people. Also thought on page, let's see, a little further down for me, this is on 261. When, and this is a different victim of racism. This is case number two, the one where it's undifferentiated homicidal impulsions found in a survivor of a mass murder. And this is where he's starting to have these different folks who are talking about all of the violence that they committed in some of them in working against colonization, some of them working to maintain it. And in case number two, this guy's talking about all of these kind of, or he says, God is with me, but he certainly isn't with those who are dead. I've had hellish good luck in life. You've got to kill so as not to be killed, when I think that I knew nothing at all about that business. And he just goes on and on and on. In my view, these phrases, they just sound like the rhetoric of white culture and white supremacy, really, because so much of racism is about violence. It's no way that you can have a minority, whites, dominate the majority of the people on the planet who are classified as not white without it being constant, ongoing, ceaseless violence. And whites, they have a lot of phrases like this. That's why they celebrate violence. It's in all the movies. I think in one of the popular films, the phrase "violence solves everything" was one of the phrases, and dead or alive, they have a lot of these types of coined phrases and jargon that celebrate violence, celebrate even lethal violence and killing people as a way of solving problems and resolving conflict. And I think a lot of times non-white people, we absorb a lot of those violent impulses and violent tendencies. Really, if anything, as I was reading this, it made me think in terms of why black people are so excited. I've said consistently, I think, because white people promote this book, the violent aspect of it in and of itself. I think I've said a few times as we've been reading this book, Mr. Nero on this program said, white people kill for fun. I would submit race soldiers, they would love anything that is talking about violence. Even if it's niggers writing a book talking about violence, they would probably enjoy that too. Because it seems that they have an insatiable appetite for killing, particularly killing and violence against black people. I think the bulk of the books that we've read in the book club would bear that out. I think for victims of white supremacy, for black people, a lot of these disorders and thinking that it's so cool with violence, I can even go back and reference Mr. Fuller again in his code book when he talks about counterviolence, when he talks about MECCA, maximum emergency compensatory action. It's if you have to kill a race soldier, you kill yourself. And many people over the years have said, oh my God, that is crazy. This Fuller dude has lost his mind. I don't know what he's talking about. And when he's explained that, he's consistently said, racists glorify killing. They glorify violence. They make it something to celebrate. You know, you kill Norm Stamper, police officer, can come on this program and say, hey, when as a police officer, we used to brag about choking people out. We used to celebrate killing somebody. And you hear that over and over again. In police departments, white people, white culture around the world. I think for non-white people, I'm not sure we can adopt that mentality to replace white supremacy with justice. And some of these disorders where, in my view, I think some, or at least when he's talking about the Algerians, and they're saying that they're having these mental disorders, they've been committing all of this violence and planting bombs and doing all of these things, and it seems to have caused some damage. Really impacted their mental health. I think that is extremely important, that just talking about even counterviolence, that's not something to be glorified. That has been engaged in. Many black people have waged counterviolence over the centuries of white supremacy, but that is not something, in my view, that's, yeah, we want to go around and celebrate and make that a joyous thing. Killing, even when you have to. I think that's the exact way that I've heard Mr. Fuller stated when just reading this portion, some of the psychological problems that these folks developed reminded me of Mr. Fuller's work greatly as we were reading. Continuing, let's see, some of the other things that stood out. Let's see. And I even think it even some of that goes back to what he talked about earlier, just in terms of the violence of white supremacy, what he calls colonialism, that has many victims of white supremacy in an agitated state anyway, where we're already frustrated and just looking to spew that violence on another non-white person. I did think he had constructive commentary about that kind of in the early stages of the book, first two audio segments, not audio segments, I think the first week segment and then the second week segment that we did a month or so back. The fifth case, case number five, European police inspector who tortured his wife and children. In my view, another one. This happens worldwide. We as non-white people, victims of racism, can carry out a lot of our frustrations. This is one, I guess it would depend on whether or not you think this is a white person or a non-white person. This was a police inspector. I was suspecting that this could have been a non-white person. I guess it would depend on, again, if you think this is a white person. I'm looking through. I don't really see anything here that speaks that would, to me, identify this as a white person. Even when he talks about, this is the section where he talks about getting Senegalese troops to participate in the beating, because after you've done this so long, your fists are ruined. Even that to me doesn't suggest like your fists have become pink or something that would suggest you have hands, the skin on your hands is without melanin, so you're, you know, turning pink or red or whatever would happen to white fists. I could see if you're, regardless, any person, if you've been beating on someone long enough that you could hurt your hands, regardless of what your racial classification is. But I read this thinking that this could have been a non-white person. And this sounds very similar to, I think, what happens to a lot of non-white people, even the non-white people who might be complying with racism, white supremacy, that they end up with a lot of the same mental problems and psychosis that this system produces, and they end up taking it out on themselves, other non-white people, I think there's been a lot of that throughout the system, and white supremacy probably will be until the system is replaced. But that's when folks can let me know, maybe, if I read that incorrectly. Also, had my President Obama moment in that same section when they get to the end and they were talking about when you the science of torturing, just so much of that sounded like racist man and racist woman, even though I think that they can employ non-white people, victims, to do this business, to do that work, the torturing and what have you. But when they talked about the science of torturing, you got to make sure that the person has some hope left, that will sustain them. If they have a hope that they're going to live, that might work out for you. Just even studying the science of torturing another human being. Also, the portion that reminded me of Barack Obama as well, the audacity of hope and the whole 2008 campaign. We talked about that with Gwen Ifill's The Breakthrough. Let's see, last two things I'll get in, and then I'll double check other folks who dialed in also. Let's see. Actually, I can pause there. I'll get to some of the other folks who dialed in with a hand up, and then I can get in my additional comments before we get to audio segment number two. Person who dialed in, last four digits, 5771. Did you have a commentary you wanted to share on Wretched of the Earth?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. What's interesting is, in my translation, you just referenced that case 5. It specifically says a European police inspector tortures his wife and children as the subtitle. So I guess in my translation, this is particularly a white person, referencing a white person, since it did classify him as European. So I'm assuming it is a white person. But in this, I guess in this case, I wanted to read this small part at the end of the conclusion here in the case where he talks about the man knew perfectly well that all his problems stemmed directly from the type of work conducted in the interrogation rooms. Though he tried to blame everything on his troubles, as he had no intention of giving up his job as a torturer, this would make no sense since then that he would have to resign. He asked me in plain language to help him torture Algerian patriots without having a guilty conscience, without any behavioral problems, and a total peace of mind. This sounds like basically white racists all across the globe, where they want to feel that they're justified in their actions of white terrorism. So, you know, I look at it as you may have a few, you know, so-called white liberals who may, you know, feel a little guilty, but they still want to continue to be racist. So it's, you know, it kind of has a particular meaning to it when you talk about the system of white supremacy and how they want to normalize it and have no type of guilt of terrorizing black folks. I know most of them don't have any guilt, but the thing is, you might have a small percentage of white people who might feel guilty, but they don't want to give up the system of white supremacy. So that was an interesting last part that kind of caught my eye. But I guess that's all I have for now, and I'll mute my line.
Grand. Yep, that's in my book, too. He says he identifies the person for case 4 and 5 as being European. So these are not, presumably, these are not non-white people, at least the last two. And then I guess the other three cases that he gives, those would be non-white people. So my apologies for that. Thanks for Mr. Demery Ford said they were white people. Caller as well just now speaking up. Thank you as well. I guess that would change it dramatically, as the last caller was saying, because that would kind of lean more into the white people are victims too, and I certainly have heard a lot of that over the years, the ways that white people are also damaged and this compromises their humanity. I am surprised that more white people don't reference this case study specifically, the one for number five, the police officer who's beating up, the European police officer who's beating up his wife and children. He tied her to a chair and all that stuff to, you know, talk about, see, this is what racism does. This is how it harms white people as well. Like, I'm surprised that isn't a really popular quote from the text. But yeah, that I guess I'd have to go back and reread it, because that would kind of send my thinking in a completely different direction as to why that's even here. And again, I would think there should be some sort of note. Like, do people think that was that widespread in 1961 anywhere in the world? White people, whether they were born in France or Germany or England or the United States, a white person going to a black psychiatrist to share their innermost thoughts about beating their white wife, or, I mean, I don't know. It would seem like even something about that would need to be said, maybe, or maybe I'm just confused and not intelligent enough to understand. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have additional commentary you were going to add in?
Yes, my dear.
Yes, sir.
Okay, that still, that was important that you gave. The fact that some of these could be, you know, non-white black people in these cases. But what I thought was especially interesting, let's see, I lost my page there. There was a difference in what was read. Oh, when the guy whose wife had been raped, and the symptoms that he was exhibiting, it said that he had a lost appetite on the recording. But in the book, it says anorexic suffering. He was bedridden anorexic suffering from melancholic depression. So I think that's a lot. That's a big difference in being just having a lack of appetite and being anorexic. This guy was in very bad shape, and he was minimizing his condition, but he had some more things going on even before these things happened to him, because he had said earlier he was in love with his cousin and he wanted to marry her. But I don't know what society he may have come from. It may have been acceptable to marry a cousin there. I don't know. But he wasn't happy with his wife. That wasn't his first choice. And so he had other deep-seated issues that were exaggerated by the fact that he was taken away from his family and was rendered impotent. And I just, you know, took note of how they usually ended up, you know. And then he said at the end, he gradually accepted to listen to political discussions while his migraines and, well, the fact at the end when he told him that he was going to take his wife back and if it didn't work out, then he would see him again in Algiers. But you can just kind of fast forward ahead. And you know what that reminds me of? A story that Pam had in one of her books where someone broke into the house and they had him at gunpoint and raped his wife while he was present, and that, and the helplessness that he felt and how it wrecked their marriage later on, because she thought that he should have done something, but it was nothing that could have been done. And then this guy came to an understanding at the end that, you know, his part in all of it. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring that out, but I'll mute my line. Thanks, Scott.
Appreciate that, Mr. Debbie Forth. Just rereading the final paragraph for the audio, the first audio segment that we just completed, where he says, talking about, so this is a white police officer. He says his superiors refused to give him sick leave, and since, moreover, the patient did not wish to have a psychiatrist certificate, we tried to give him treatment while working full-time. The weakness of such a procedure may be easily imagined. This man knew perfectly well that his disorders were directly caused by the kind of activity that went on inside the rooms where interrogations were carried out, even though he tried to throw the responsibility totally upon present troubles, as he could not see his way to stopping torturing people. That made nonsense to him, for in that case he would have to resign. He asked me without beating about the bush to help him go on torturing Algerian patriots without any prickings of conscience, without any behavior problems, and with complete equanimity. To me, just looking at that again, like, oh, okay, so this is a white person. Like, wow, that does not sound revolutionary to me. That does not sound like the Bible of black liberation and counterviolence. Am I reading this correctly? Franz Fanon is helping this white person, and even the white person before this, he is helping them. And this white man, in fact, is coming and asking that he help him deal with his PTSD from torturing Negroes. Am I just making sure I'm grasping this correctly with my puny Negro brain? Is that how you all understood this?
Wait a minute, repeat that again, Gus.
Just, am I understanding this final paragraph correctly, that Mr. Fanon, he's been working with this white European officer who basically came in with his PTSD and was asking for Fanon's help to deal with his PTSD that he acquired as a result of beating black people, Algerians. Is that what I'm reading here?
Yes. Yes, that's, you know, and the guy said earlier that he wanted to be, he knew that he was sick, that he knew he had a problem, he wanted to be well. But when it come to stop doing what he was doing, he didn't want to hear that. He didn't really want to go there. And so it says the Algerian patriots, without it, having a guilty conscience, without any behavior problems, and with total peace of mind. And then if you look at the bottom, at the footnote, it'll tell you, you know, that the different stages of how he was feeling. And he was already in the second stage, that was only radical and absolute sadistic. So, yeah, you were correct.
Amazing. Oh, the other caller, were you going to comment as well, sir?
Yeah. No, you're right. It you know, it seems like a diagnosis to, you know, to try to help some white European police inspector to get over his small consciousness of beating Algerian patriots. But the question that I'm trying to, and it doesn't say it in this particular section, but I'm wondering if the wife may be non-white. I mean, that's a question that just popped in my head. Like, you know, I wonder if the wife is not white. Probably is why he's torturing, you know, maybe torturing her and the child.
That is certainly a possibility. That is a great line of inquiry. That I guess for me too, I am more accustomed to racial classifications being made clear, as opposed to just placing a geographic label on someone, that this is a European or an Algerian and that sort of thing, because you just don't, like what you just talked about, you just don't know who the wife is, that sort of thing. But yeah, that would be very, very interesting to find out what's going on, because particularly since he's talked about there's so much sexual violence going on anywhere. That's such a big part of the system of white supremacy anyway. Any other
comments, observations, folks want to make sure they get in before we move along to the second audio segment? Folks satisfied? Grand. Again, we will only have one more session. We'll be done with the book next week. So any final commentary, you can get that prepared for next Friday. This session is a little bit shorter. I could have made it, I guess, the typical length, but then we would have had a really, really super short section next week. So I just tried to balance that out so they'll be relatively the same length the last 2 weeks here. So we are picking up the section of the book. This is Series B, and it's case number one, the murder by two young Algerians, 13 and 14 years old, respectively, of their European playmate. That's the first section. I guess for me, it's on page 270. Might vary depending on, you know, which translation of the text you have. This is France Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy. If you did not get to share and you have commentary, just make a note so you don't forget. We will have ample time once this audio segment concludes. Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number two.
Series B. We have here brought together certain cases or groups of cases in which the event giving rise to the illness is in the first place the atmosphere of total war which reigns in Algeria. Case number one. The murder by two young Algerians, 13 and 14 years old, respectively, of their European playmate. We had been asked to give expert medical advice in a legal matter. Two young Algerians, 13 and 14 years old, pupils in a primary school, were accused of having killed one of their European schoolmates. They admitted having done it. The crime was reconstructed and photos were added to the record. Here, one of the children could be seen holding the victim while the other struck at him with a knife. The little defendants did not go back on their declarations. We had long conversations with them. We here reproduced the most characteristic of their remarks. A. The boy, 13 years old. We weren't a bit cross with him. Every Thursday, we used to go and play with catapults together on the hill above the village. He was a good friend of ours. He used to not go to school anymore because he wanted to be a mason like his father. One day, we decided to kill him because the Europeans want to kill all the Arabs. We can't kill big people, but we could kill ones like him, because he was the same age as us. We didn't know how to kill him. We wanted to throw him into a ditch, but he'd only have been hurt, so we got the knife from home and we killed him. But why did you pick on him? Because he used to play with us. Another boy wouldn't have gone up the hill with us. And yet you were pals? Well then, why do they want to kill us? His father is in the militia, and he said we ought to have our throats cut. But he didn't say anything to you. Him? No. You know he is dead now. Yes. What does being dead mean? When it's all finished, you go to heaven. Was it you that killed him? Yes. Does having killed somebody worry you? No, since they want to kill us, so... Do you mind being in prison? No. B. The boy, 14 years old. This young defendant was in marked contrast to his schoolfellow. He was already almost a man, and an adult in his muscular control, his appearance, and the content of his replies. He did not deny having killed either. Why had he killed? He did not reply to the question, but asked me had I ever seen a European in prison. had there ever been a European arrested and sent to prison after the murder of an Algerian? I replied that, in fact, I had never seen any Europeans in prison. And yet there are Algerians killed every day, aren't there? Yes. So why are only Algerians found in the prisons? Can you explain that to me? No, but tell me why you killed this boy who was your friend. I'll tell you why. You've heard tell of the rivet business. Yes. Two of my family were killed then. At home, they said that the French had sworn to kill us all, one after the other. And did they arrest a single Frenchman for all those Algerians who were killed? I don't know. Well, nobody at all was arrested. I wanted to take to the mountains, but I was too young. So X and I said we'd kill a European. Why? In your opinion, what should we have done? I don't know, but you are a child, and what is happening concerns grown-up people. But they kill children, too. That is no reason for killing your friend. Well, kill him I did. Now you can do what you like. Had your friend done anything to harm you? Not a thing. Well, there you are. Case 2. Accusatory delirium and suicidal conduct disguised as, quote, terrorist activity in a young Algerian, 22 years old. This patient was sent to our hospital by the French judicial authorities. This measure was taken after medical and legal advice given by French psychiatrists practicing in Algeria. The patient was an emaciated man in a complete state of aberration. His body was covered with bruises and two fractures of the jaw made all absorption of nourishment impossible. Thus, for more than 2 weeks, the patient was fed by various injections. After 2 weeks, the blank in his thoughts receded. We were able to establish contact, and we managed to reconstruct the dramatic history of this young man. During his youth, he went in for scouting with unusual enthusiasm. He became one of the main leaders of the Muslim scout movement. But when he was 19 years old, he dropped scouting completely in order to have no preoccupation other than his profession. He was a multi-copying machine maker. He studied hard and dreamt of becoming a great specialist in his profession. The 1st of November, 1954, found him absorbed by strictly professional problems. At the time, he showed no interest at all in the national struggle. Already, he no longer frequented the company of his former companions. He defined himself at that time as, quote, completely bent on increasing his technical capacity. However, about the middle of 1955, when spending the evening with his family, he suddenly had the impression that his parents considered him a traitor. After a few days, this fleeting impression became blunted, but at the back of his mind, a certain misgiving persisted, a sort of uneasiness that he did not understand. On account of this, he decided to eat his meals quickly, shrinking from the family circle and shut himself into his room. He avoided all contacts. It was in these conditions that catastrophe intervened. One day, in the middle of the street, at about 12:30, he distinctly heard a voice calling him a coward. He turned around, but saw nobody. He quickened his pace, and decided that from then on he would not go to work. He stayed in his room and did not eat any dinner. During the night, the crisis came on. For 3 hours, he heard all sorts of insults coming from out of the night and resounding in his head. Traitor, traitor, coward, all your brothers who are dying, traitor, traitor. He was seized with indescribable anxiety. For 18 hours, my heart beat at the rhythm of 130 pulsations to the minute. I thought I was going to die. From that time on, the patient could no longer swallow a bite. He wasted away almost visibly. He shut himself up in complete darkness and refused to open the door to his parents. Around the third day, he took refuge in prayer. He stayed kneeling, he told me, from 17 to 18 hours on end each day. On the fourth day, acting on impulse like a madman, with a beard that was also enough to make him be taken for a madman, wearing neither coat nor tie, he went out into the town. Once in the street, he did not know where to go, but he started walking. And at the end of some time, he found himself in the European town. His physical appearance, he looked like a European, seemed then to safeguard him against being stopped and questioned by the police patrols. As a contrast to this, beside him, Algerian men and women were arrested, maltreated, insulted, and searched. Paradoxically, he had no papers on him. This uncalled-for consideration toward him on the part of the enemy patrols confirmed his delusion that everybody knew he was with the French. Even the soldiers had their orders. They left him alone. In addition, the glances of the arrested Algerians who were waiting to be searched, with their hands behind their necks, seemed to him to be full of contempt. The prey of overwhelming agitation, he moved away, striding rapidly. It was at this moment that he happened to walk in front of the building, which was the French staff headquarters. In the gateway stood several soldiers armed with machine guns. He went toward the soldiers, threw himself upon one of them, and tried to snatch his machine gun, shouting, "I am an Algerian!" He was quickly overcome and was brought to the police, where they insisted on making him confess the names of his, quote, superiors and the different members of the network to which he supposedly belonged. After some days, the police and the soldiers realized that they were dealing with a sick man. An expert opinion was sought, which concluded that he was suffering from mental disorders and that he should be sent to the hospital. "All I wanted to do," he said, "was to die. Even at the police barracks, I thought and hoped that after they tortured me, they would kill me. I was glad to be struck, for that showed me that they considered that I, too, was their enemy. I could no longer go on hearing those accusing voices without doing something. I am not a coward. I am not a woman. I am not a traitor." Case number 3. Neurotic attitude of a young French woman whose father, a highly placed civil servant, was killed in an ambush. This girl, 21 years old, a student, came to consult me about certain minor symptoms of anxiety complex which interfered with her studies and with her social relationships. Her hands were constantly moist and at times presented very worrying symptoms when sweat flowed all over her hands. Constrictions of the chest accompanied by nocturnal headaches. Bitter nails. But the thing that was most apparent was above all the over-easy contact, obviously too rapid, while a severe anxiety could be clearly sensed underlying the facile approach. The death of her father, though judging from the date fairly recent, was mentioned by the patient with such lightheartedness that we quickly directed our investigations toward her relations with her father. The account which she gave us was clear, completely lucid, with a lucidity which touched on insensibility and later revealed, precisely by its rationalism, this girl's uneasiness and the nature and origin of her conflict. My father was highly placed in the civil service. He was responsible for a very large rural area. As soon as the trouble started, he threw himself into the Algerian manhunt with frenzied rage. Sometimes it happened that he would eat nothing at all, and not even sleep. He was in such a state of excitement over putting down the rebellion. I saw, without being able to do anything about it, the slow metamorphosis of my father. Finally, I decided not to go to see him anymore and to stay in town. The fact was that every time I went home, I spent entire nights awake, for screams used to rise up to my room from down below, in the cellar, and in the unused rooms of the house. Algerians were being tortured so as to obtain information. You have no idea how terrible it is to hear screaming all night like that. Sometimes I used to wonder how it was that a human being was able to bear hearing those screams of pain, quite apart from the actual torture, and so it went on. Finally, I didn't ever go home. The rare times that my father came to see me in town, I wasn't able to look him in the face without being terribly frightened and embarrassed. I found it increasingly difficult to force myself to kiss him. For you must understand that I had lived a long time in the village. I knew almost all the families that lived there. The Algerian boys of my age and I had played together when we were small. Every time I went home, my father told me that fresh people had been arrested. In the end, I didn't dare walk in the street anymore. I was so sure of meeting hatred everywhere. In my heart, I knew that those Algerians were right. If I were an Algerian girl, I'd be in the Maquis. One day, however, she received a telegram which announced that her father was seriously injured. She went to the hospital and found her father in a coma. Shortly afterward, he died. He had been wounded while on a reconnoitering expedition with a military detachment. The patrol fell into an ambush laid by the Algerian National Army. "The funeral sickened me," she said. "All those officials who came to weep over the death of my father, whose, quote, high moral qualities conquered the native population, disgusted me. Everyone knew that it was false. There wasn't a single person who didn't know that my father had the wimp hand of all the interrogation centers in the whole region. Everyone knew that the number of deaths under torture reached 10 a day, and there they came to tell their lies about my father's devotion, his self-sacrifice, his love for his country, and so on. I ought to say that now such words have no meaning for me, or at any rate hardly any. I went back to the town directly afterward, and I avoided all the authorities. They offered me an allowance, but I refused it. I don't want their money. It is the price of the blood spilt by my father. I don't want any of it. I am going to work. Case number 4. Behavior disturbances in young Algerians under 10. These children were refugees, the children of fighting men or of civilians killed by the French. They were sent to various different centers in Tunisia and Morocco. These children were sent to school, and games and outings were organized for them. They were examined regularly by doctors. That is how we came to have occasion to see some of them. A. In each of these different children, there exists a very marked love for parental images. Everything which resembles a father or a mother is sought out with the greatest tenacity and jealousy guarded. B. Generally speaking, they all have a noise phobia which is very noticeable. These children are very much affected when they are scolded. They have a great thirst for peace and for affection. C. Many of them suffer from sleeplessness and also from sleepwalking. D. Periodical enuresis. E. Sadistic tendencies. A game that is often played is to stretch a sheet of paper and feverishly poke holes in it. All their pencils are chewed and their nails bitten with distressing regularity. They quarrel frequently among themselves, despite a deep fundamental affection. Case number 5. puerperal psychoses among the refugees. The name puerperal psychoses is given to mental disorders which occur in women around childbirth. Such disorders may appear immediately before or some weeks after giving birth. The determinism of such illnesses is very complex, but it is considered that the principal causes are the upsetting of the functioning of the endocrine glands and the existence of an, quote, affective shock. The latter heading, though vague, covers what most people refer to as, quote, violent emotion. On the Moroccan and Tunisian frontiers, there are to be found something like 300,000 refugees since the decision of the French government to practice their burnt earth policy over hundreds of kilometers. The destitution in which they exist is well known. International Red Cross committees have repeatedly paid visits to these places, and after having observed the extreme poverty and precariousness of living conditions, they have recommended increased aid to these refugees from international organizations. It was thus only to be expected, considering the undernourishment which is rife in these camps, that pregnant women there should show particular propensities for the development of puerperal psychoses. The atmosphere of permanent insecurity in which the refugees exist is kept up by frequent invasions of French troops, applying, quote, the right of following and pursuit, bombardment from the air, machine gunnings. It is well known that no further attention is now paid to bombardments of Moroccan and Tunisian territories by the French army, of which Sakie Sidi Youssef, the martyred village in Tunisia, was the most appalling, together with the breakup of homes, which is a consequence of the conditions of the evacuation. To tell the truth, there are very few Algerian women who give birth in such conditions who do not suffer from mental disorders. These disorders take various forms. Sometimes they are visible as states of agitation, which sometimes turn into rages, sometimes deep depression and tonic immobility, which include many attempted suicides, or sometimes, finally, anxiety states with tears, lamentations, and appeals for mercy. In the same way, the form which the delusions take are many and diverse. We may find a delusion of persecution against the French who want to kill the newborn infant, or the child not yet born, or else the mother may have the impression of imminent death, in which the mothers implore invisible executioners to spare their child. Here, once more, we must point out that the fundamental nature of these problems is not cleared up by the regression and soothing of the disorders. The circumstances of the cured patients maintains and feeds these pathological kinks.
Context of white supremacy, what a interesting word to conclude on. Pathological kinks. That said, if folks have commentary they would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Again, we have one session left, and then we'll be moving on to brand new book next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern. Or excuse me, not next Friday. Next Friday, we have one more session, and then 2 weeks from today, brand new book. Looking forward to that. But before we get to that, we will finish up Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. The folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have any comments? Second section that we cover today, any comments? Line should be open. Proceed.
Yeah, Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, he started on Series B. Oh, very interesting. The 13-year-old and 14-year-old Algerian boys who had killed a European playmate. And it seems the way that it's written, you would think that this seemed to be bizarre if kids were just playing together and then all of a sudden the Algerians who understood the situation where they were at war then would kill a playmate. And then when he started questioning, it was interesting because he took it, you know, to a racial classification when he told him, asked him about there were any Europeans in prison. And if he'd ever heard of any Europeans being arrested or in prison for killing an Algerian. So I think it was totally different with the 14-year-old. He was had sort of gotten to the point to where he wanted to really do something about the situation. And that's what's happening nowadays, the so-called jihadists. The terrorism that's being inflicted upon their families and their countries are actually creating young jihadists and resistance fighters. So these kids may have seen, well, the book even pointed out in footnote 26, when he told, one of the boys told him about Rivet. And then the footnote that Rivet was a village in the region around Algiers, which became headlines in the news in 1956. One evening in the village was raided by French militia who drug 40 men from their beds and murdered them. So if those kids knew about that, then, you know, they had made up in their minds, I guess, their contribution could be to extinguish his friend, and they didn't seem to have much remorse about it. But, you know, that's quite the contrary to what's going on with young people, ancestors of ex-slaves here. They don't seem to be realizing that there's a war being waged against us, and there's a lot of confusion. And then the only thing I had, or the next case was, you know, this particular case remind me of when we were reading the book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, and one of those characters was a light-skinned black man, and he had a complex because he didn't want to be mistaken as a white boy, and he had these issues. And it seemed like this guy, that it said that his physical appearance, he could have been taken for a European. And it seems to have protected him from being stopped and questioned by French police. And people were being arrested right next to him. He was, I guess, pale. And they thought he was a white person, Frenchman, European, whatever they call it. And in his mind started playing tricks on him. He kept hearing the word traitor and coward being shouted out, and drove him to a point of insanity where, you know, and that goes on today where I've seen cases where people stand out in front of police house, shoot me, you know, suicide by police is something that's real even now. But he was willing to give up his life, you know, to you know, prove a point that he wasn't a coward. And see some of the other. Oh, the girl, the French woman, and her father, one of the worst officials could be, running those interrogation centers, and probably had practiced racism and terrorized, killed, you know, no telling how many. And then they painted her as benevolent. But then when they killed her father, you know, she said that they offered her financial support afterwards, but she turned it down. It's like she could identify with the people that were, that her father had been terrorized. Yeah, that last one, the case five about the psychosis, I was thinking the one I knew about was postpartum psychosis. This, I guess it's familiar, but this one, I guess, is a psychosis that comes during the pregnancy. And yeah, and it has, you know, it looks like, and if you're in a refugee situation, you know, it just brings to mind, you know, even the people that's devastated by the hurricane in Puerto Rico, you know, think about those that are being relocated or whatever, and the pregnant women, those with medical conditions, you know, it just brings, you know, additional suffering. And then it looked like they asked for additional help. But even if they, it said in the end that even if they treated the symptoms, that even if the patient was cured, her predicament maintains, nourishes the pathological complications. I think you mentioned that at the beginning. So I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Indeed. Indeed. Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For if any other folks, if you have commentary you want to make sure you get in before we conclude, feel free. I know folks have been spectating and or voicing their displeasure, discontentedness with Mr. Fanon's work, but we are almost done. Some of the notes that I have that I wanted to, that I took from the second session, I guess when he had the note on the patient, the female, I guess this is another white person, white woman, where her dad was some sort of racist official, and she felt bad. She felt guilty, I guess. We got another guilty white person. I don't know how to pick these vignettes up. I mean, again, I think, you know, when I heard about this book before I read it, well, before years before we got to it on the book club, when I heard about this book, and, you know, as I said, this is the Bible of a black revolution and, you know, counterviolence and sticking it to the man and all that. And then, you know, you get to the end and it's multiple times being presented with white people. I don't know if they're well-meaning white people, but certainly white people who feel guilty or are presented as feeling bad in some way about their involvement in colonialism in Algiers, and even coming to him for assistance, where ostensibly maybe as a psychiatrist, that's his job, is to help them, you know, get their act together and get over this. I think he said in the previous segment to help this white terrorist to help him continue torturing black people and not feel bad about it. And then this white woman to get her, to, I guess, to help her get over her guilt about her father. I don't know how to process that and or why that would inspire large numbers of black people to say, oh yeah, this is a great book that you should read about how, you know, white supremacy makes some white people feel bad. If anything, again, I go back to, now why is this book so popular? These would be other illustrations that I would point to and say, oh yeah, I can see why racists would definitely get behind and support a book that has this sort of material in it. And, you know, making the point that, oh, yeah, that racism, white supremacy compromises white people's humanity, too. And they feel bad as even ripping apart their family, mother against daughter, son against father, and, you know, so on and so forth. Let's see, some of the other ones. The first vignette, since that was not about white people, I really appreciated just some of the questions that were being asked. I think it was the 14-year-old. I think Mr. Demrefour already touched on that in terms of why are there no Europeans in prison? Have you ever seen a European sent to prison? And they just keep trying to redirect it. But yeah, there are no Europeans in prison. Yeah. But you killed your friend. You killed your friend. That white and friend. The whole time I kept going through that, those terms should never be together. And it seems like this 14-year-old, it seems like he was just following the logic, which, man, everything about this system is designed to prevent our brain computers from doing that. Following logic, we're not supposed to just come to, hey, these whites are enemies to us. Maybe I should function in a manner that reflects that. No. You're not supposed to do that. They're well-meaning. They're good. You just need to be patient with them. Tell them they're ignorant about racism, all the other malarkey that they get us to accept. And I think Dr. Kambon, on one of his previous visits on the program, he was saying that this happens when you have black people where their self-destruct button gets shut off and all of the anti-black concepts, all of that gets shut off, and we start to accurately understand what it means to be white and how we should relate towards them. That's exactly what this vignette of these two Algerians who killed this non-white child, it's exactly what it reminded me of. Let's see. The scene, I thought Mr. Demrefour, I thought his commentary where this young Algerian who maybe could have quote-unquote passed, as they say, for a white person, about how this gets motivated even 2017 throughout the system of white supremacy, where non-white people who you're not black enough, you're not whatever that means, you're not down enough. And that can cause a lot of problems too, can cause a lot of conflict, and then doing things that are generally or often not constructive to try to prove your blackness to other non-white people. Lots of illustrations where that has not been constructive at either. And again, that's all of that racist most to blame. Let's see. Yeah, I just don't know. Just going back to the report about this French woman, I just don't know what to make of all that. Even when she's saying that she found it increasingly difficult to kiss her father. And, you know, that just sounds really, really rhetoric-y. It's very, very difficult. That sort of thing just further turns me off from this sort of reading. It makes it difficult for me to read and focus on, because I just don't believe that sort of thing. Even if it is true, you're still a racist, in my opinion. I don't care that you found it difficult to give old dad a hug that evening. You're still benefiting from, you're still practicing, more importantly, racism, white supremacy. Who cares if you feel bad about it for, you know, a few seconds a day? The person, the previous caller who dialed in, 5771, if you had commentary you wanted to add, you should be with us as well.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, in the first case with the two Algerian boys, with the 14-year-old, he's a very, I mean, the way he's responding to the question, responding with questions and very good questions. But I think you touched on this before about the use of violence against racism. It's like, it's not very productive, you know, if it's going to hurt more non-white people. And I guess in this case, two Algerian boys are now arrested, going to be thrown in jail and tortured and, you know, whatever. So, and the 14-year-old seems very intelligent in regards to his responses to his questioning. So, but now it's like, you know, he killed that white boy. It's like, now he's gone now, you know, presumably dead, you know, while in jail, because I'm pretty sure white people don't like it when, you know, non-white people, you know, kill them. So, Mr. Demery Ford touched on the second case, and I was thinking the exact same thing about Pretty Willie from The Spook Who Sat by the Door, and how, you know, he had to prove, you know, his blackness, and how he can pass, you know, for being white since he was so, you know, so light. So I was thinking the same thing when you said that. So that was a very interesting comparison with that character from the other book that we read in book club. So that's all I have on Me and My Line.
Indeed, Sam Greenlee, Spook Who Sat by the Door. About this time last year, we were reading The Spook Who Sat by the Door. About this time, yours truly did the narration. If other folks have anything else they want to get in, feel free. We will not need to hang out until the end. We finished all our audio segments, so if folks don't have additional commentary, we can wrap up a little early. I did think that section, the final segment, case number 5, puerperal psychoses among the refugees. I thought that was really important as well. That reminded me of Killing the Black Body, a book that I've raved about on this program for years. Dorothy Roberts' work. She's been a guest on the program 3 times. Her work was referenced in Medical Apartheid, but just talking about the abuse that black pregnant females experience in the system of white supremacy, and just all of the abuses that we experience anyway. And then, as Mr. Demery Ford was saying, to add on that being pregnant and denied resources, I think Asada Shakur, I think there are quite a few books where we've touched on that, what the total lack of regard shown not only for females, but for maternity period, no value for the black child's life, the black mother's life. Total disregard. The symptoms that were listed off as well, in terms of what I guess some of the things that they became accustomed to seeing in the children specifically, the bedwetting, the sleeplessness and sleepwalking. A lot of these symptoms, I suspect, are prevalent amongst black people right now, right here in the States. I know the sleeplessness, I hear that from listeners and myself on a regular basis, maybe not sleepwalking per se. And having phobias, I think that's a big part for non-white people as well. I think even something that we've talked about before, where you have non-white people who are afraid to ask for a raid or afraid to ask questions of a job, are afraid to just do basic things in terms of applying themselves for fear that they might be retaliated or subjected to additional terrorism under the system. I think a lot of these symptoms are quite widespread. And he was saying that these are symptoms that he was seeing in Algerians under 10. Again, the importance of talking about racism, white supremacy with children. Any other comments folks wanted to make sure they get in? Anything else? If you have not dialed in and you have a comment, you go ahead and get your hand up now. Anything else folks wanted to make sure they get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. With that case 4, it's interesting. Like in my translation, it says the cases are refugees, sons of freedom fighters or civilians killed by the French. They have been allocated to centers in Tanzania and Morocco, and they are provided with schooling and games and outings are organized. And this, you know, reminds me of the current system of non-white black boys and girls in basically kind of like the orphanage system that we have here, where, you know, most of the time with young non-white black boys and girls, you know, if they're orphans and they've been, you know, entered into the child care system, quote unquote, that, you know, they're constantly abused, and, you know, they come with these similar symptoms that, you know, that you mentioned in regards to that. And sometimes even symptoms that's not even listed on here, even worse cases. I don't know. I think there was somebody. Well, I mean, there's been a lot of reports about how majority of black boys and girls within the system are, you know, constantly abused by, you know, foster parents and, you know, by
officers and, you know, sometimes even caseworkers in that sense. So kind of reminds me of the modern day orphanage system here with black boys and girls. That's all I have.
Indeed, indeed. And he said, he wrote rather, Fanon wrote noise phobias. It was not just phobias, but noise phobias, that he was another pattern that he was seeing in children, which I'm not sure that I would say. In fact, I might even say it's the other way. It seems to be here, where it's have lots and lots of noise as a part of the distraction in terms of just trying to, I think Dr. Welsing has talked about just desensitizing yourself so you could just drown out everything with lots and lots of noise. But the quarreling, I think that's E. I do see a lot of that as whirl, that they, he says they quarrel frequently among themselves despite a deep fundamental affection. I think there's a lot of that amongst victims of racism. I think that even gets into a lot of the name calling and what have you, just lots and lots of conflict motivated by the system of white supremacy with no real outlet for a lot of our frustrations as we continue to be mistreated. Any other commentary folks wanted to make sure they get in? Other observations, things that stood out from the reading from this week? Grand. We'll assume folks are satisfied. Again, we will be done next week. Last session. Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, will be great. We'll pick up on Series C, right at the beginning of Series C, and we'll go right to the conclusion. If you have any concluding thoughts on the text, I want to get out your last frustration, anything else that, you know, patterns, things that have stood out over the few months. We even had the disruption with a couple weeks we missed where my back was injured, but any final thoughts folks want to pull together, prepare for next week, as we will be moving on and picking a different book, in my opinion, better book, to read next time around. If you want to write in your commentary, you can feel free to do so untiljustice@gmail.com, and we'll be sure to include whatever your analysis is next week when we get rolling. Mm-hmm. Oh, did I miss? Was that Mr. Demi Four?
Excuse me. Yes, excuse me, Gus. I just wanted to say that the next book, if you had any tips on how to get it, the only ones I can see, it looked like it's out of print, like you said, and then it's like $40 or something to get it. I appreciate any information you have on getting a copy of that, or if it's a PDF of that. That's it.
Absolutely. Neil Postman, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. It is out of print. I think when I read it years ago, I just went to the library and they had it. I suspect that that might be a challenge for this one, or at least going to like a public library. This might be one that you might have to go to a university library to get, or even with the interlibrary loan. Sometimes if you go to the library and they don't have the book at their library, they might be able to get it from another neighboring library. That might be an option. I've been looking for a PDF for this text as well, because other people were trying to read it, and we had a listener, she was going to volunteer, Mel, she was going to volunteer to read the text. I was trying to see if it was available, if there was a PDF or what have you, but as you stated, this is an older book. It's out of print. I have not been able to track down a PDF as of yet, but I will see if I can locate one. I did get a copy of the book, but I was just able to get a used copy, fortunately. But as of this point, at least at this point, this Neil Postman book is a little bit difficult to find, which I don't know if that means anything about the constructive value of the text. When I read it, I thought it was constructive. And I guess in 2 weeks, we'll begin the book so folks can make their own determination if they think it's valuable. But I think great book. I enjoyed it. And, you know, it gives a lot of helpful tips about, or just things to think about in terms of the way that we use words. So I'll continue to look over the next week or so. If I find anything, I will make sure I get that info to you, Mr. Demery Four, and I'll post it on Facebook or what have you, so that other folks, if they want to make sure they have the book and are ready to roll when we get ready in 2 weeks, I will let you all know as well.
Okay. Thanks, Chuck.
With that, really excited about Neil Postman. I've read several of his books, and
enjoyed everything that I've read by him. Looking forward to that. With that, I will encourage folks this weekend, if you're, you know, at least here in Seattle, yes, it's autumn, but it's still pretty warm and sunny. So if you are enjoying the last little remnants of what was the summer of 2017, live it up, enjoy, but you still want to be codified. And in my view, that would mean you certainly do not want to be intoxicated as you are out gallivanting for the weekend. You do not want to have a race soldier, badge or no, interrupt your good time where you might be required to make life-saving decisions in a matter of seconds. I don't think being intoxicated, whether it's alcohol, cigarettes, any other toxins that whites have dumped on us, I don't think that that is going to help you make great choices in that moment of pressure. And on the whole, I don't think any of white's intoxicants have helped us solve our problems. If anything, they have hampered us tremendously and made it way easier in many instances for whites to continue terrorizing us. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. And especially if you are going to be in a vehicle, driver, or passenger, you do not want to be intoxicated, and make sure you buckle up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.